Welcome to Flower Hour.
A podcast completely dedicated to baking. I'm Amanda in Atlanta.
And I'm Jeremiah in Sacramento.
Hi!
Hi, Amanda!
How are you?
I'm well. How are you? We've got the giggles already.
I'm doing really well today. My kids are back in school after holiday break. Today's the first day back, and I am not mad about it.
Well, that sounds good. Back to reality.
Yeah. So what have you been baking lately?
Wow. What have I been baking? Oh, a couple nice things. Stuff for my book. One are these little passion fruit little cakes. We call them queijadas, but they're little passion fruit. I don't want to call them a cupcake, but they're like mixed between a little cake and a little tart. And they're delicious and really, really strongly flavored with passion fruit. And the other one is this fun dessert, kind of like a layered dessert, which translates to I don't know dessert. We call it pudim nasce. And I imagine that some Portuguese cook was whipping up a last minute dessert and it was so good. And everyone asked her, what's it called? And she's like, I don't know. I don't know dessert. So it's really nice. It's a base of cookies that I soaked in port wine. And then it has a layer of pineapple and then chocolate mousse that's spiked with more port wine and some whipped cream. And I think traditionally it's just a really simple, almost like a trifle. But I stabilized the whole thing with some gelatin so I could present it as a whole cake, like a mousse cake. And
like more freestanding instead of in a dish.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. And that's kind of fun to know. If you have time to play with gelatin amounts, you can turn any layered dessert into a proper freestanding cake. And it doesn't take much. For instance, I think I used about a teaspoon to a teaspoon and a half of gelatin in each of those layers to stabilize them. And then I decorated the whole thing with piped meringues, which I broke apart and tried to make look like a modern art sculpture.
Well, I saw it on Instagram and I think that you succeeded. It looked very modern and beautiful. And maybe you said it on Instagram, but I was like moving too fast. But those flavors are so interesting. I've never heard of those together. Like I would not think of that.
Yeah.
And now I want to try it.
Yeah, it's delicious and it does sound weird. And I think that goes back to this, well, in my version of the story, that this cook just had those things on hand and was like, I just need to get something on the table. So pineapple, chocolate, it's going to work. And it does. It really does. But I think it'd be fun to sub out the pineapple for, I don't know, cherries or kind of things that you would think would be more typical. But I definitely, the pineapple's good.
Yeah, it's weird because I never thought of pineapple and chocolate together. I mean, I know you can dip it, but in a like a proper dessert like that, I never thought of it. But with the acid and the chocolate, I think pomegranate and chocolate go nicely together. Orange and chocolate go nicely together. So I'm going, why not do pineapple? It seems, seems so natural. And then, okay, so for the passion fruit cakes that you were talking about, what do you bake them in? I was curious because you said it's kind of cupcake. You bake it in a tart pan or...
So you're supposed to bake them in the Portuguese egg custard tart tins. So the pastéis de nata. Okay. So those, and what I, so if you're interested in making those type of tarts and you really want to get into it, you can buy them on Amazon. I was shocked because before I've always brought them home from Portugal, but they have them on Amazon. They're marketed as egg custard tart tins because people, those are also very popular in Asia. So I think there's a demand for them. Anyway, you can buy them for less than a dollar a tin, like in packs of 10 to 20, super affordable. But if you're not willing to make that jump, you can use a mini muffin pan or just even a regular muffin tin and just fill them maybe half to three quarters full, maybe more on the half side. They won't have the same flared shape as if you use the proper tins, but they'll still be delicious.
I love that they're baked in that because I've made your recipe for the egg tarts before and I did it in a muffin pan because I didn't have the proper tins, partially because I'm like, this is the only thing I would bake in them.
Right.
So And I don't really like single use gadgets in the kitchen or, you know, right. pans or whatever. But if you have, you know, that recipe and then you make the egg custard tarts next, now you're making a case to me to go shopping, basically.
Yes, yes. I love that. I'm always inspired by how you are very careful about what you purchase for your kitchen, where I'm like, I'm buying everything and then it's a hot mess in my pantry.
I've noticed that bakers are in one of two categories when it comes to gear. Either you love lots and lots of gear, which I feel like a lot of bakers do. My brother's that way. Selassie mentioned he's that way. You're that way. Like, a lot of bakers love all this stuff. And then there's this like weird group of us who are like, I want to see if I can, you know, bake all my cakes in my coffee mugs or something, like, just because we don't want to buy anything ever. So, I think it's good to have both. And I really wish we were neighbors, because then I could borrow all of your pans.
Yes. Oh, that would be fun. That'd be really fun. Well, what have you been baking this week?
Well, like I mentioned, my kids just started back at school today. So Christmas break felt like it went on forever. And one of my daughter's gifts for Christmas was a robotic cat. It's like a little cat robot that we have living with us now. Her name is Annie. And my daughter let me know that it was Annie's birthday and that she had requested chocolate cupcakes with strawberry frosting, which, interestingly enough, is her favorite combination. So she has a lot in common with her robot cat. So I've been baking cupcakes. I had a cupcake order, and then I had cupcakes for my daughter's robo cat. And thankfully she shared. They were delicious. we sang her happy birthday and everything. I mean, it was like a proper party. But then the very next day I found out that some other of her stuffed animals, it's also their birthday coming up. So,
oh my gosh.
I'm either going to have to accept my life of stuffed animal party planning or have a conversation. And I haven't decided which direction I'm going to go in just yet.
What are those cake consultations like?
Yeah. with critters that cannot talk. Well, my daughter is a take charge type. She's happy to talk for all of them. So, yeah, they're actually very specific. She's my neediest customer of all. And then I knew, so this episode is all about gluten-free. We haven't even told everybody yet, but it's gluten-free. And I knew this was coming. We're going to be talking to a gluten-free specialist later in the episode. And so to prepare for that, I've made it clear my New Year's resolution is to try some of these free from baking techniques to make some cakes. And I made my first gluten-free layer cake.
Oh my gosh, how did it go?
I was like really happily surprised. I kind of imagined this huge arc of, you know, make 20 terrible cakes and then maybe 20 mediocre ones and then one day finally get to something good. But I mean, it feels a little strange to say, but it was delicious. The first one was great. I used Bob's Red Mill 1-to-1 baking substitution. I used a recipe that I use all the time for vanilla cake, and I whipped it up just the same as always. And it was really good. Because I've had the cake so much, I definitely noticed some differences. There was a slight, this sounds really negative, but it actually, I didn't think it was unappealing. There was a slight like powdery mouth feel after you swallowed the cake, and the color of the cake was different. I did notice. So normally it's kind of a yellow, it's a vanilla cake that's kind of yellow normally. And this flour made it look just ever so slightly green. It was just a little tiny bit green. And it wasn't, I wouldn't say it was an unappealing green, but it was slightly green. So something to be aware of, I don't know, if you're going to be doing this for someone.
Which blend did you use?
So I used the 1-to-1 where you just straight sub it. I've used the other one before to make a batch of cupcakes. I forget what it's called. It's still a straight substitution, but then you're supposed to add your own xanthan gum.
Right.
And I hope I'm saying that right. But I didn't really want to have to add anything. So I used this one that, I mean, you literally, if you use a cup of flour, you use a cup of this mix and that's all you do. And it was great. And I cut up the cake. I served it to my kids and my husband. And my husband knew, so it wasn't a full blind test for him. My kids did not know that it was any different. And they gobbled it up. They, you know, I kind of like looked at them like, did you like it? And they said it was really good. So, I mean, I feel like it was successful. And my husband liked it too. He said if he was served it at a party, he would feel like it was a great slice of cake. So, win.
I love that. Good job.
Yeah, thank you. So with the gluten-free topic, I was curious, I think that you've mentioned that your husband, Jonathan, was gluten-free for a time period. And I was curious, did you bake for him then? Or, you know, what's your experience with gluten-free baking?
Yeah, you remember absolutely correctly. When I met Jonathan, he was, he doesn't have a disease like celiac that requires gluten-free eating, but he was gluten sensitive and preferred to eat that way. And I baked for, that was the first time I'd ever been aware or tried to do anything gluten-free. And I'll be super honest. I come from a bread loving, cake loving, gluten loving family. So it was a bit daunting to think that I was going to have to kind of put that type of baking on hold. But then the curiosity in me was like, well, let's see what we can figure out in this whole realm. So this is a few years back when there wasn't many blends on the market, just a couple. There was Bob's Red Mill, and then there was also Cup for Cup, which is done by Thomas Keller, his whole franchise, the French Laundry, Bouchon Bakery.
And
that one was super expensive, and I actually think it's still very expensive, but that one existed. So I started off with Bob's Red Mill, and I think nowadays they have two different or a few different options. But the one back then, it's actually a very funny story. I bought that one, and we were actually, Jonathan and I were vacationing at his parents' vacation home in South Carolina, and it would be the first time I was going to meet them, and I wanted to bake them a cake. And so I was baking them my favorite tartine cake, which is their summer Bavarian fruit cake. And it's a beautiful chiffon cake layers with a pastry cream and fresh fruit. It's one of my favorite cakes. And so I was using the Bob's Red Mill. We made the cake and, okay, side story. The center of it didn't cook all the way through. So I remember like, we didn't have a lot of time. So I'm scooping out the center. And I decided I'm going to make it look like a tube pancake, like a donut cake.
You're like, yeah, we'll just turn it into a bundt cake. No one will know.
Exactly. Okay. So that's fine. It all looks great. We're eating it and they're all being polite. I'm like, yeah, it tastes delicious. But Jonathan and I are like, there is some sort of vegetal flavor in this cake. So I run and get the bag, and Bob's that original type of flour has fava bean flour and garbanzo bean flour in the mix.
So you made them a hummus cake.
Yes, it was hummus cake with fresh fruit and pastry cream. Delicious.
Sounds wonderful. You had nowhere to go but up from there.
So true. So I still think that's a good flour, but I would use it for savory bakes for sure. And then these days I would buy their other one, which I checked out, and I think it's called One for One, and it is only, there's no bean flours in it. So you're safe on that realm. So, okay, to keep going with the story, I decided to make my own blends. And I amassed quite a bit of different flours, brown rice flour, white rice flour, sweet rice flour, all the different starches. And one of my favorites was actually sorghum flour. Sorghum is a beautiful flavor and has a great, great texture.
Which I think that's in the one-to-one mix that I used. I think there's just a little bit of the sorghum flour in there. I think I noticed that. Yeah.
It's a great flour. Millet flour also I found really well. It's very neutral tasting. And then of course I had xanthan gum on hand, which is really expensive, but you don't have to use very much. And what else? I tried all kinds of stuff. I tried breads and pizzas, and some of them required psyllium husk.
Oh, which wow. Is,
yeah, that's a really high fiber supplement, and you would have to soak that first, and that creates a lot of elasticity for a bread type of dough.
Okay.
So I kind of went to the extreme side of things, where really trying to understand all these different ingredients and play with them. But these days, you really can just buy these awesome blends off the shelf, and now they're not so expensive as they used to be, and things are tasting good.
Yeah, I think it's a lot more approachable than it used to be. It's, you know, before, I do remember, maybe a few years back, kind of looking up some recipes, and to make your own blend is really intimidating and expensive if you're not, like, especially, I feel like if you've gotten a diagnosis and medically you need to do this for your diet, that's one thing. You know, you're going to be in this for the long haul. But if you're thinking, I would just like to reduce gluten in my diet, or maybe... or cut it out for a time, you may not want to invest in so much. It's just really kind of overwhelming to look at. I want to back up just a tiny bit because I'm curious, and I'm sure you know this answer, and I'm just not sure myself, but xanthan gum, what does it do? Because I do see that a lot with gluten-free. It'll say, you know, add in a little bit of it. Do you know, what does that do?
So I believe that it's, really takes over that gluten structure element of flour. So, you know, when liquid combines with wheat flour, it activates this gluten chain that creates the structure for your breads and cakes to rise. You're missing that in all those gluten-free flours, right? And starches. There's no way for those starches or flours to connect with each other. So the xanthan gum creates that stickiness or that elasticity, and you don't need much because otherwise it really becomes this completely gelled product. So you only need a little bit to create that, to simulate what gluten would do with wheat flour.
Okay. So it's a structure building type ingredient. Okay.
Another flour that I love to play with is buckwheat flour. Now it's confusing because the name of the flour says wheat, but buckwheat is completely gluten-free.
That is tricky. Yeah. If I saw buckwheat, I'd be like, oh, definitely not good for gluten-free.
So I think it's important too, to look at types of bakes or types of flours that we use in specific bakes that are just naturally gluten-free. And you can find dishes that are like, oh, wow, I didn't know that that is meant to be gluten-free from the start. There's nothing you have to change about it. But buckwheat has a really, really interesting flavor. If you've never had it, I recommend trying it. I think traditionally you see it a lot making like little bellini pancakes to put smoked salmon and caviar if you can, and some creme fraiche. But Tartine, one of my favorite bakeries, also has a recipe for buckwheat chiffon cake.
Oh.
And it is so good. And they paired it with citrus. I think it's citrus marmalade and dark chocolate. Such a good pairing because the buckwheat has such a strong, interesting flavor, and it paired so well with those other flavors. And I needed no xanthan gum or any other starches. You can just use, for that cake specifically, the buckwheat. It's good to go. I think there's enough eggs and meringue to lighten it.
That's amazing. So really all you have to buy, you know, to do certain things is just maybe one extra ingredient and you're good to go. And that brings up a really interesting thought I haven't thought about in a while, but I really like baking in a box. Like if you can put some restrictions on what I need to make, that was one thing, like when we were preparing to be on the show, I felt like in some ways it made us be creative because if you say, here's this recipe brief, you have to make pavlovas, you have to make this many, you have to do it in this time, suddenly your creativity is more focused.
Absolutely.
I like the idea of putting parameters on things, like saying, okay, you're going to bake this, it's going to be gluten-free. And then you find things like the buckwheat flour that whether you're gluten-free or not, suddenly you're adding flavor where maybe a normal, traditional, all-purpose type flour, you're not really using that as something to bring flavor.
Yeah.
So, and then you have this baked good that's better than it would have been, and it's gluten-free.
Exactly.
Another thing with gluten-free baking that I wanted to talk about is I feel like there are a lot of, and you touched on this, but there are a lot of gluten-free bakes that we eat all the time, whether we're gluten-free or not, but that's just, they are by nature gluten-free, like meringues. And we both love meringues and pavlovas. I know that.
Yes.
Also, macaroons.
Yeah.
And macarons, I mean, are very, you know, so funny. Coconut, and then also almond. Those, of course, you know, are the main ingredients in those, and they don't have gluten. So a lot of times there's treats that maybe, you know, if you have a friend that is gluten-free, because that's what I think about a lot with entertaining. Yeah. If someone's coming over to your house, you want them to feel comfortable. And it doesn't make somebody feel comfortable if you're like, you know, well, I would have made a cake, but you're gluten-free. Like, that's not nice. So
it's
nice if you have things that maybe you're really comfortable with, because also you may not want to test your first dip your toe into gluten-free baking the first time when you're hosting. So there's things, ice cream, gelatin, these things, mousse, chocolate mousse, gluten-free.
Yeah. And I think that if I could wish for a big takeaway from this episode is to think about for people to change their minds about gluten-free. If you can go down the route where you're substituting to create traditional wheat bakes with gluten-free flours, that's great. But also to have your mind open up to the fact that there are so many desserts that we bake and eat that are just naturally gluten-free. And so to think, just like you said, to think about all those things that you already have in your repertoire that are naturally gluten-free. And for me, I was thinking, being a lover of Portuguese desserts, there are so many, and I know other European desserts that are made with just almond flour, for instance.
True.
Or there's other ingredients that make up the structure of that dessert that doesn't even need gluten and you're good to go.
True. I didn't even think about the almond flour desserts that much, but there are so many.
So many.
Particularly with European baking. And a lot of times they do have some, you know, traditional all-purpose flour added. But I'm curious. Mm-hmm. I bet that would be a good place to start if you were trying to make a recipe that's not gluten-free and you're going to sub one of those mixes in. If it's not 100%, you know, all-purpose flour, and suddenly you're just taking out half of the flour, and maybe it was already a lot of almond flour, that might be a good place to start. Now I want to play with that a little bit.
Yeah. And one more plug for Tartine is Elizabeth Pruitt, the creator of Tartine with her husband, Chad Robertson. She is now also gluten-free. So their newest book, Tartine All Day, all of the desserts are gluten-free. So that's a place that I love to look because I trust her immensely. And that's a huge goldmine of recipes that are naturally gluten-free. And she has cakes, beautiful chocolate cakes that are all done with almond flour. And I've made her Dutch baby pancake. And that's done with some oat flour and some buckwheat. And so the flavor, I sometimes think some of those things, if you use the more flavorful flours, have a greater flavor profile than if you were to use just white flour. So there's this big room to play with all these fun flavors.
Totally. And you saying that makes me think too, because I always think flavor, texture, and it adds the flavor. And then also sometimes the texture, I think with gluten-free, a lot of times the mentality, at least for myself, is like, how do I make this taste like a traditional, you know, fill in the blank?
Yeah.
But I think maybe a nice approach sometimes too is just being open to something that's really, really delicious, because that's the ultimate goal. And I have used rye flour in the past. Mm. I mean, and we're not talking about gluten-free here, but just different flours that can bring textures.
Yeah.
So possibly there's a lot of great gluten-free bakes that have unique flours that bring texture and flavor that can make something very special and stand out. Because isn't it fun when you have something that someone's like, oh, I love Jeremiah's blah, 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 you know, and it's a way to be kind of unique, I think, with your baking.
Absolutely. So experiment, try these interesting flours.
Yeah. So I feel like we're doing like a commercial for gluten-free two people who truly love gluten full baking. And now I've made a thorough case to myself of gluten free. Yeah. But why not? I think if your goal, and for me, I want to be a dynamic baker. I don't want to just be in one lane. I want to experience the world of baking. And to me, it's a very exciting segment that's growing. It's new. It feels like a new frontier. And there's a lot of places where you can explore and almost maybe still put your mark on it. So
absolutely. I had the same thought in my mind, because now instead of thinking about, well, how can I change the filling, the icing, the flavors of the components, now you're changing the core essential structural component of your dessert, which means you can put this whole new spin, like you said, on something in a really unique way. And I think that's fun to experiment with.
Definitely fun. Playing is fun. Experimenting is fun. So, well, I have a lot of questions about gluten-free baking, and I happen to have a really great connection with someone I used to work with, Sally. I used to work with her a long time ago. She has her own gluten-free bakery, and I would love to bring her on and talk to her for a bit.
I'm so excited. Let's get her.
All right. We are so excited to welcome Sally Chasteen, my personal OG of gluten-free baking, to Flower Hour. Thank you so much for coming on with us, Sally.
You're welcome. I'm happy to be here.
Welcome.
Welcome. Yeah. So just a little bit about Sally. I used to work with Sally. I was trying to remember, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, about 10 years ago. Was it that long?
Maybe longer, 2007.
Okay. Yeah. So 10, 11 years ago at Nordstrom, we used to work together, and Sally was gluten-free then. And at that point in my life, she was the only person that I really knew who was gluten-free. And she brought in, it's such a vivid memory, I think, just because I'm such a food person, but she brought in the most delicious cookie cake for one of our birthdays, and it was gluten-free. And being completely unknowledgeable on the topic, I was like, I don't know. Like, I don't, is this going to be good? And I ate it, and it was delicious. It was incredible. So I had a really great start to gluten-free.
Good.
Thanks to Sally. And then from there, she went on and started her own gluten-free bakery that is still in her family. I've visited it, and it's delicious. It's here in Atlanta.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's great. I had a great experience. I just went the other day, actually, and I had some chocolate chip cookies, not surprisingly, and they were as good as the delicious cookie cake and brought back the fond memories. Anyway, but I've been dying to ask you, because I kind of knew you in a fashion sense, but we really didn't talk that much about baking before. How did you get started as a baker?
Well, I guess to take it way back, my mom grew up in a house, you know, where scratch baking was just a part of life. And then when she had children of her own, she passed that along. So my dad jokes, I was sitting on the counter cracking eggs with her when I was 2 years old. And we always had, you know, a homemade birthday cake, and wasn't super fancy, but, you know, we loved it. And flash forward to when I was in high school, my mom was having a lot of health issues, and doctors just kept saying, you know, oh, you have three, you know, middle school and high school age children, you're just tired. And she finally found someone who was willing to look at diet as maybe the reason for some of her issues. And she decided to go gluten-free, and she didn't really have the time to make different food for her and the rest of our family. So we all went gluten-free, at least inside of our home. And my brothers and I all started feeling better. We didn't realize that maybe we were tired or had some upset stomach issues. And so we just kind of started taking all of our favorite recipes that we had grown up eating, like banana muffins when we had ripe bananas on hand, or, you know, fresh chocolate chip cookies. We started just making those gluten-free with different flours and experimenting with the ingredients. And this was all throughout, you know, high school and college. And then one day my dad kind of realized, hey, I think there's a need for this. You know, people were asking us what we were making. The same doctor that had helped my mom had started giving other patients our product, when we would bring it to her, we'd be like, oh, try this bread we made. It's gluten-free. And she would give it to other people. And then I would get a phone call saying, hey, can you bring me a loaf of this bread? And I had no idea who this person was. And it just kind of grew into a business really organically. And then in 2009, we decided to open an actual, you know, bakery. And it just kind of grew from there.
What a cool story. Like I said, I had never heard that before. So I was curious kind of how it all started. I think that's amazing that it started in such a natural way and definitely from a need. Because like I said, and I'm sure different parts of the country are different, but here in Atlanta, it was a foreign idea, you know, at the point you kind of introduced me to it.
Right. I think there were back in 2009 and 2008, when we were starting out at home, there were a handful of brands you could get at Whole Foods, or back then there was a farmer's market store called Harry's, and they had, you know, one or two brands, I think from Canada, but again, they were in the freezer. Supply was very limited and definitely no, you know, ready-made mixes on the shelf for people who maybe wanted to try the baking in their own kitchen, just needed a little guidance. So yeah, there definitely wasn't anything out there. So when people found out there was someone baking gluten-free that could get it fresh, they were jumping all over it.
Well, that's so interesting. But take me back to when you guys were first starting to bake gluten-free at home. What was that experience like? Was it successful right away in terms of like, did everything come out really well? Or were there some flops that you're like, oh, that flour blend was not right?
Oh my God. Even when we think about the things that people were, you know, calling us wanting, those first products, like one that we did was a kind of pseudo hamburger bun, English muffin. It could go either way. It was awful. Like I can't, like thinking back to, you know, that's what people were ordering from us by like the dozen because they were so desperate. But looking back, like they were probably dry, gummy, you know, just weird. And we definitely, my mom and I had to kind of take a step back because I'm sure y'all know, I feel like 95% of stuff tastes really good warm out of the oven.
Yes.
But the true test is like once it's cooled down and maybe even the next morning, how does it taste? And most of our stuff, like if we were patient enough to wait, it was, you know, okay, but nothing like what's out there today. We probably dumped, you know, so much just brown rice flour into things, not realizing you needed to mix the different flours that are available to get different properties, you know, kind of experimenting with, okay, well, if we add an egg to this, I think it'll be better. So it was very scientific in a way.
Now, do you guys have a background in food science or how did you guys figure all this out? You sound very professional already at this stage.
I mean, I think it was just my mom having grown up cooking and been a scratch baker her whole life, she knew what different ingredients did and that, you know, if something was dry, maybe it needed more fat and you could get fat either through an egg yolk or more oil, or, you know, adding a little bit more baking soda or baking powder could kind of, you know, help give something a little more rise without changing it too much. But yeah, no, neither. My mom was a labor and delivery nurse until she decided to stay home with my brothers and I, and I was a fashion merchandising major. So not a lot of professional training over in our house.
Wow.
I think it's really cool that, I mean, it sounds sometimes maybe overblown to say brave, but I think it takes some bravery to kind of start tweaking and trying these things. Cause, and as a busy mom too, I mean, thinking that she had three kids and you hate to invest the time and the energy and the money in something and then go, it could be a flop for her to do that. Yeah. I think it's really cool that she had that drive and desire to do that for her and for her family. It's really special.
Right. No, I agree. I think food is definitely a love language for a lot of people. And, you know, her desire to feed herself and then be able to share that with our family was pretty strong to, like you said, take the risk of making a lot of bad food. And it's also not cheap. I mean, to just buy like lots of ingredients to potentially throw them away, you know.
And that's heartbreaking. It doesn't matter if it's a gluten-free bake or if it's a gluten-full bake. If you make something and it doesn't work out and then you have to trash it, it's like you see the money and everything going down. And so,
right.
Yeah, that's a challenging moment for all bakers, I think.
Yes.
For people who haven't baked gluten-free, like what are the types of flours and starches and gums that you would use to create something for okay. someone who doesn't know what's in them?
Yeah. So in order to take all of our recipes that we had grown up eating and try and make them gluten-free, we had to figure out how to replace the flour. And in simple terms, gluten is a natural property in like wheat flour that helps it make it elastic. Think about, you know, pizza parlors where they throw the dough up and twist it around. That's the gluten that helps make it so elastic. And so when you take that out, you know, a flour like brown rice flour, it has no gluten. So you have to kind of mix it with something like tapioca flour or cornstarch that's maybe lighter, but still gives you like some thickening and stickiness. Because brown rice flour on its own, which we learned the hard way, is too dense. It's too heavy. It just makes a really like dry and gritty product. So we were trying to find different flours that were naturally gluten-free, like rice, tapioca, corn, and potato, and then figuring out how we could mix them to get, you know, like I said, that first product was really a hamburger bun, English muffin, something that wasn't too dry and crumbly, but also wasn't like a super elastic, weird dough thing. And then, you know, double checking that things like the baking powder and baking soda and salt were also gluten-free. Because for a lot of people, even just a, you know, little bit of gluten can still make them really sick. And then there's also a few pre-made flour blends out on the market. Even 10 years ago, there were some available. And so it was just kind of trying to figure out how maybe we could make our own version of that and save a little money by mimicking the properties of the blend.
That was a big question that I got when I asked on social media if anyone had questions for you. Just really quick, I wanted to say, so Lauren Smur from Instagram, by Sabine with an underscore from Instagram. Let's see, a couple of other people, their main question was, is there a mix that you would recommend, and or would you recommend different ones for different things? Like, do you say, you know, do Bob's Red Mill for cookies and do King Arthur flour for cakes, that kind of thing?
So I definitely am a fan of Bob's Red Mill. They, I think, are a great company. They are dedicated to, you know, keeping their facilities gluten-free when they need to. And I personally have had great experience with their one-to-one baking mix. It's what I keep in my pantry at home. I have used it, you know, to make fried squash, you know, something that is savory. And then I've used it to make, you know, an angel food cake. So it's light enough that it can hold up. I have used the King Arthur flour blend, the gluten-free all-purpose mix. And sometimes you can even use a pancake mix if that's, you know, what your store has available. You know, some people in smaller cities might not have a great, you know, gluten-free section available to them, but you just want to make sure, you know, if it has vanilla in it, you know, that might not be the best for a savory kind of ingredient. But I personally like the mixes that are available in the stores. I think it's easier than trying to gather, you know, 12 different ingredients and figure out the right proportions. So I think those have come a long way.
That's good to know. I just used the Bob's Red Mill one-to-one and I had a really good experience with that. So I'm glad it's not in my head.
Yeah, no, that's right now that one's on the top of my list and it's readily available. So I think that's an awesome product for people to look for if they want to try to, you know, make something from scratch or, you know, make something for a friend who's gluten-free and surprise them with a treat.
Is there anything you need to do differently if you're making a bread type product?
I personally haven't made a lot of bread at home with that product. I make more of like cookies, cupcakes, but I don't think so. I mean, my only concern might be that it might be too heavy, but I think if you sifted it and all your other ingredients were staying the same as the recipe, I think that's their big push is that you can sub it cup for cup in any recipe and have it, you know, turn out the way that it's supposed to.
Kind of along the lines of bread, I have a question from Twitter from LF low flow B2. That's a riddle in itself. They wanted to know, do you have any recipes like from online, any bloggers or anything that you would recommend for gluten-free bread specifically?
There's none that I follow that are big bread people. I personally like following, you know, the name is just a coincidence, but Sally's Baking Addiction. She posts a lot of cookies, cakes, but she also does have breads on her website. So I would suggest checking out those people, but there's none that are specifically like all gluten-free all day. I'm not sure if that exists even. So I'm not sure if that answers that person's question.
Yeah, it sounds like a good jumping off point at the very least. Yeah, definitely. I had a question because I just made my first gluten-free layer cake. Like I said, I used the Bob's Red Mill 1-to-1 and I really liked the way it tasted. But when I was mixing, I had this thought pop in my head and I was curious. So normally when I'm making a cake, the biggest thing that I'm watching for towards the end is to not overmix. Like I want to make sure everything's consistent throughout, but I don't want to overmix because of the gluten development. I don't want a tough cake. With gluten-free, can you just endlessly mix and make it, you know, even more and more smooth, or do you still run into problems?
I mean, honestly, at the bakery, one thing we do, we mix everything like at least 3 minutes. I feel like I don't, and maybe it would taste better. Maybe that's one way we can improve our products is trying to mix it less, but it's a tough balance. Like you said, you want to make sure all your ingredients are thoroughly blended. You know, the butter's off the bottom of the mixing bowl. And also gluten-free tends to be so dense that you kind of want to whip. We like to whip things to get some air in them. So I'm not sure, honestly, if you can overmix gluten-free.
Yeah, it seems like maybe it would be to your benefit to add a little extra mixing time, maybe at a high speed, like you said, to kind of whip it, add some air. And since you're not worried about it becoming, you know, chewy because of the gluten, why not get crazy and mix it up a little longer?
Right. Don't even set a timer. Just forget about it.
Yeah. Go walk the dog, go get your kids, let it mix away.
Exactly.
What was it like transitioning into a bakery? Was that a fun experience?
I think overall, yes, it was fun. I personally have no like business experience. And so we brought my brother on board. He was graduating from college with a major in real estate. And about that time, there were not many real estate jobs because of the economy. And so we brought him on board to kind of be the brains of the business. And my dad was very business minded, so that helped. But I also think running a family business is just interesting because you see each other at your worst, but you know, you're still family. And luckily for us, we're all still talking to each other, but it's definitely a fine balance. And there were lots of days, you know, where I was single at the time and I would, you know, come home and my roommates would have left me a late plate for dinner, or lots of, you know, making a pizza at the bakery to eat your dinner because you just can't even leave yet. So it's definitely, you know, totally what they say. I feel like the cliche blood, sweat, and tears, you know, all of the emotions go into starting a small business.
That's so cool.
Here's the lightning round of gluten-free questions. So from Twitter, James Hillary, which by the way, he was a contestant on the most recent Bake Off, British Bake Off. His at is Cluck Muck Cook. And he said he's probably going to be baking a wedding cake later this year, and he needs one of the tiers to be gluten-free. And he was curious if you had any suggestions for that, like specific to gluten-free wedding cake making. I don't know if he wants to know about the building of it or if he wants to know about recipes, but just does anything pop to mind that you'd like to suggest?
Well, I did make a gluten-free wedding cake one time. It was for my cousin. It was 3 tiers and it was like 90 degrees that day. And our cream cheese frosting kind of like got a little too warm and the top tier slid off of the middle tier.
Oh no.
So that, I mean, you know, she was like, whatever, she didn't care. She's very laid back. But my only advice would just be to make sure, you know, you try your recipe out with plenty of time, you know, weeks ahead, just because gluten-free can tend to be so dense. I would hate for it to, you know, be like too heavy and you're planning on it being the top tier and kind of smush some things. But in general, you know, I think it should be easy and, you know, hopefully it'll go well. But my advice would be to, you know, plan it out ahead of time.
And don't do it on a 90 degree day with cream cheese.
Right. Exactly.
Okay. And then Baked by the Bell from Instagram says she uses her own blend of rice flour and a few starches, but the rice leaves a noticeable texture that she doesn't care for. Is there anything that you'd recommend her adding to the mix to fix that?
I'm not sure if she's tried or has access to sweet rice flour. I feel like that is kind of similar to tapioca and cornstarch in that it's really light and can maybe still give her some of the properties of the rice flour without being as gritty. I'm assuming maybe she feels like the brown rice is gritty. So that would be my advice, would be to try the sweet rice flour.
Perfect.
Have you noticed that sometimes it's called glutinous rice flour?
Oh, I've never seen that.
So out here in California, we have a lot of Asian grocery stores, yeah. And it's an easy place to get that flour. And it is translated usually in those stores as glutinous rice flour, but it's not glutinous. It's just, I think, another word for sticky.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's also the type of rice used to make sticky rice. But what's nice, if you have an Asian market, it's usually less than $1 a bag. It can be really inexpensive.
Right. And especially maybe for the people who aren't super like gluten-free because of, you know, an allergy, maybe they're just trying to be gluten-free to cut back on processed foods or whatever. I feel like the Asian markets are a great resource for them.
Well, that's a really good idea. Okay. Also Baked by the Bell from Instagram. She had another question of, do you have any tips for making gluten-free laminated doughs?
One of our employees that works for us, she's experimented with some kind of stuff like that, but nothing's ever really come out very well. So I don't know. I don't think I have any answers for that.
We'll put that in the work in progress column.
Yes. How about that? Yes. I wish. Send me some in the mail.
RC Swipegart from Instagram says, what's the best way to make gluten-free baked goods less dense and less grainy? Which I think is kind of similar to the previous question, but do you have any tips?
I would say if you have a specific recipe you've been trying, I would switch up your flour blend. If you've, you know, been making your own, maybe give one of the store-bought ones a try. Maybe add an extra egg or just an egg white, or more fat, you know, can sometimes help with the mouthfeel of things. And I feel like in a lot of recipes, you can add an extra egg yolk and not mess with the proportions too much. So I would try, yeah, maybe a different flour blend, or mix up your ingredients a little bit.
Okay. Awesome. And that wraps up all of my social media questions. So there's your social media lightning round.
Awesome.
I had a question just because for me, trying to make, having a cake business and just in general with friends, I've been kind of jokingly, but also seriously saying cake for all. And so for me, I'm trying to learn how to make a great gluten-free cake, a great vegan cake, and a great dairy-free cake, like just different versions throughout the year. And I was curious, just as a baker in general, is cake a good place to start if you're not familiar with gluten-free baking? Or is there anywhere in particular that you would say, if you just want to try your first gluten-free baked good, what would you recommend?
That's honestly a toss-up for me between cake and cookie. And then also, I don't know, banana bread just popped into my mind. I feel like everyone can appreciate a good loaf of banana bread. But I do feel like cake is just kind of a universal way to celebrate. And that's one thing that people get so excited about when they come into our bakery is that they can still have a birthday cake and be gluten-free, especially if it's a child that's having to be gluten-free. Cause I think it's a really hard diagnosis for some people to, you know, accept. And they're like, oh, but how am I going to celebrate my birthday? So I do think with the flour blends available at the stores, you know, if you have a good recipe that you love, I would start with a cake and, you know, with lots of eggs, it should turn out well, eggs and butter. And then Amanda, if you want to get adventurous, you know, taking out some of those other ingredients does make it a little tricky, but for the majority of people, I think making a gluten-free cake is a great place to start.
Okay. That's good to know. I feel like it's pretty approachable. Like it used to feel so intimidating, but definitely like with the one-to-one flowers, you feel like you at least have a pretty good chance of something coming out. So it's not, I don't think it's as intimidating as what you guys had to go through. That's for sure.
Right. One of my closest girlfriends actually sent me a text yesterday morning when she was at her Kroger. She sent me a screenshot that Pillsbury now has a gluten-free Funfetti cake mix. So, you know, it's just like ready to go. All you have to add is the oil and the eggs, I'm sure. So it's definitely way more approachable, like you said.
Absolutely. We have restaurants and bakeries here in Sacramento that don't even advertise as gluten-free, but their complete baking line of stuff is. And I just think that's amazing that these in this day and age, you can put yourself forward as just another bakery. And then everything you do is gluten-free and people love it. There isn't a big difference like there used to be years ago.
Right. I think that's awesome. I think that just makes it, like you said, Amanda, cake for all, food for all.
Yeah. I was just going to ask for Sally, like what's next? What's the next thing that you're going to be baking that's gluten-free? Just something to kind of tempt us on the way out.
Well, actually last night I made some grain-free blondies using coconut flour, which is a little different than some of the other things we've talked about. It's you use way less, like you use 2 tablespoons for a whole, you know, tray of the brownies, but those are all gone. Those were delicious. And then there's an angel food cake I love by Ina Garten that I make whenever we have, you know, a birthday coming up or, you know, just having family over for dinner. It's one of my favorites.
Those both sound delicious. I'm really happy to hear you say that about coconut flour too. I'm going to have to beg you for that recipe because I want to bake with coconut flour. Like I really have this determination and I've had quite a few flops. So I need...
Yeah, coconut flour can have a really different texture. And also a lot of recipes with coconut flour have a ton of eggs. So it's just a different feel. But I think I sent you this one for the blondies. You make your own pecan butter for them, which is kind of an extra step, but you could get store-bought. But it's so good. And my friends that were over last night watching the football game, they were amazed that these were grain-free, refined sugar-free, and they were awesome. So
we're definitely going to have to try those, Amanda.
Yeah, it's on my to-bake list for sure. Maybe even today.
Let me know. Let me know how they go.
I will. All right. Well, Sally, thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time. And it's kind of nice to have the excuse just to catch up and talk to you and hear about this part of your life, for sure.
I know. Thank you so much. And I hope I helped answer some of your fans' questions.
Thank you. I think you did. You made us happy, that's for sure.
All right. Well, that was really fun getting to talk to Sally and then just thinking a lot about gluten-free baking. I feel super inspired to bake with all sorts of things, coconut flour and baking mixes. Anyway, I got to scoot because I have a lot of gluten-free baking to do now.
And if all you are inspired to take on some gluten-free baking, please share your bakes with us, post pictures, and tag us with hashtag Flower Hour.
We'd love to see them.
Be sure to subscribe to Flower Hour on iTunes or SoundCloud. And if you're enjoying your time with us, leave us a review. We'd appreciate it.